afternoon. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here. I'm the host of In Context. I'm here with my fellow host, Gus Cantavero.
Hey, everybody. Happy Halloween.
And behind the boards, doing double duty, is our military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe.
Good afternoon, everyone.
We come to you every Monday between noon and 1 p.m., and we lead off a new public affairs interactive radio block here at WPKN from noon to 1 p.m. every weekday. We're on Mondays, except on the first Monday when you have the WPKN Listener Report. And Tuesdays, we bring you Indigenous Radio with Cheokas and Ghost Horse. And Wednesdays, from noon to 1, we have Health Issues, the Emotion Roadmap with Chuck Wolf, who takes your calls. And most of these programs, we take calls. On Thursday, the Organic Farm Stand with Guy Beardsley and friends, except for the last Thursday, when we continue the agricultural motif with the Vet Show with Julia Clark, who will take calls to give you advice on your pets' issues. And then Fridays, we have the Review of the Arts in Our Communities with Richard Feniger. And we're trying to get closer to our community. We are a community-based radio station, so please tune in noon to 1 for our new interactive public affairs block. And today's show is our special monthly report, the War Report. Every, at the end of every month, we kind of update you on what's been going on in the global wars around the country. And today we're going to take a look at wars. But before we do, we have a special announcement regarding a community activity that's going on in Ridgefield. Gus, do you have the information on that?
Yes, I do. It is the Ridgefield Liberty Cooperative, and they're sponsoring an event at the Ridgefield Town Hall on Thursday, November 3rd at 7 p.m. And they're inviting people to come by to have an open conversation, you know, a very democratic debate about the Republican candidates who are running for president. And they want to just have an open forum where you can come and talk about the candidates and kind of discuss ideas and, you know, what concerns you, you know, share some of your ideas or solutions that you may have for America and some of the problems in the world as it stands.
So this is a grassroots civic action here that you can participate in this Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Ridgefield.
True community action without an agenda.
Very good. Thanks, Gus. And today's show, we're going to take a look at the war as it goes around the world, all the way from Afghanistan to Africa. And the question for today, and we'd like you to call in and give us your opinion, is, are these wars in the interest of the United States, in the interest of its people? And the call-in number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And if you'd rather email us, we'll read your question or comment on the air. Do so by contacting us at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. Well, now it's the 10th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan. Are we winning the war? Is the end in sight? What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, I think the end, at least from a military standpoint, is far from in sight. The security situation in Afghanistan has just been deteriorating particularly for the last couple of years. I mean, we see the growth of the Haqqani network and various other resistance movements, the rise in U.S. casualties, the brazen attacks in Kabul on Afghan forces as well as U.S. forces. Just this week alone, 13 U.S. soldiers were killed in a single attack on a U.S. convoy, which is devastating number of casualties for one day's fighting.
And this was in Kabul, right?
And this was in Kabul, in what should be the most secure place in occupied Afghanistan.
Yeah, I'm looking at this article here from Press TV. It says there's 150,000 U.S.-led foreign forces in Afghanistan. That's a mind-boggling number of troops.
And yet the Soviets could not conquer Afghanistan with what? A much larger army, right?
They had roughly close to 1 million men in Afghanistan. The thing is that the Afghans come from a warrior society. They fought each other. Most of them tribally fought each other from the time they were young children. The average American soldier shoots his weapon twice a year, usually minimum twice a year,
really?
And shoots them at their 45 targets. I'm sorry, 40 targets at, you know, varying ranges of 50 meters, 100 meters. And you do lying down, kneeling, and, you know, so on and so forth, supported, unsupported. And then you never do anything else with it. On the other hand, the Taliban, they don't have these advantages of automated ranges and whatnot. No, they actually shot at each other. And the way you grow up to adulthood is you didn't get killed fighting. So really, we are fighting not some militia, but battle-hardened veterans who probably were veterans before most of us were learning our ABCs.
They may not be as good a shot as the American soldiers who have all this stuff, but they're tough.
Oh, they're tough. And I mean, you know, these guys, they can hold their own under fire.
And one of the themes as we look at the Afghanistan war or the war in Pakistan, or even as we'll talk later about Africa, it's the central theme here is the desire to control access to oil and gas and other important minerals. And, of course, the Afghan war, which started right after 9/11, was essentially about controlling the important oil natural gas corridor from the former Soviet republics down through Pakistan. And that effort was led by a consortium led by UNICOL, and it's not much discussed. But in order to understand the whole global wars, you need to keep that in focus. Now, that war is spreading into Pakistan, the Afghan war. What's going on in Pakistan?
Well, in Pakistan right now, there's been an increase in the number of drone attacks. Now, for those listeners that don't know, these are unmanned aerial vehicles. Basically, they're if you imagine those model airplanes you used to fly by remote control as a child, it's kind of like those, except much more computerized. It's flown by a guy sitting in Las Vegas who's never been to Afghanistan.
With an Xbox controller.
With an Xbox controller, quite literally. Yeah. And, you know, launching missiles that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars at things that he's not entirely sure what he's looking at. And so that's one of the reasons why we keep blowing up weddings and funerals.
Right. And our officials in the Pentagon have said that acceptable losses are killing 200 innocent people to get one target.
Exactly. Which, when you think about it, is an absolute absurdity. But what's interesting is there's nothing new in history. This is the same thing the Germans did when they blitzed London, when they blitzed the British major British cities. The hypocrisy of these people is amazing. Because we killed – let me ask the audience something. What is the difference between killing 200 innocent Afghans and some guy walking into an American mall with a suicide vest and killing 200 innocent Americans? Absolutely nothing, because both are unarmed civilians, women and children. And killing civilians doesn't matter who you are or what the reason is. It is terrorism, plain and simple. Definition of terrorism, using violence to further a political or military gain.
You know, you mentioned to me earlier today, Marshawn, when we were talking about the analogies with World War II, is the way that the German government would constantly portray anybody who opposed it as terrorists.
Oh, yes. Now, that's something that's very fascinating. We like to think, you know, and this is the very two-dimensional view of history that we're given. In order to get the understanding I had to watch 14 hours of a documentary. You know, it's nuts. But basically, Hitler, what's interesting is he didn't dissolve the government. He didn't come to power in a military coup like a lot of these banana republic dictators. He was elected and on a very strong anti-communist stance. Ooh, we must beat the Reds. And then the burning of the Reichstag, he said, this is an example of communist terrorism. And he passed the Enabling Act, which, you know, is sadly similar to the USA Patriot Act, you know, on the pretenses of combating what he said was communist terrorism, who wanted to blow up and kill innocent Germans, communist Jewish terrorists.
So when you were hassled by the Gestapo, it was always to protect you from communist or Jewish terrorists.
When the Gestapo came in and reported your neighbor or asked to search your house, or the RSD, the Reich Security Service, asked to look through your belongings or your bags, it was to protect you from communist terrorists. Hitler, what's fascinating is Hitler operated within the confines of the Weimar Republic. The Third Reich, it wasn't like he toppled the Weimar Republic and became dictator. The Enabling Act was in the Constitution of the Weimar Republic. And so then he used, again, similar to the USA Patriot Act, then used the law against itself to combat terrorism.
So nothing ever really changes. If you just tune in, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And the name of the show, In Context, we're doing our monthly our monthly war report, which we do at the last week of the month, where we review the global wars the United States is involved in with our military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. My fellow host is Gus Cantavero.
So the biggest difference between the Nazi tactics and our form of security now is that the Nazis were sharper dressers. They had much nicer uniforms.
Yeah.
And they had a higher level of education, because if you talk to the average TSA agent, they're just a bunch of thugs.
Well, and one thing I will say is, you know, the Nazis had the Gestapo and the RSD, the Reich Security Service, and we have the Homeland Security and the TSA. The only difference, though, is I will say this for the Reich Security Service. They had those very shiny boots, and they were in shape. You ever seen these guys at the TSA? Like, the tangs on the pants are holding on for dear life, you know?
And I wouldn't say that the analogy between us and the Germans is precise, or us and the Russians, us and the British, us and the French, or any of the previous great powers that sought to dominate the world. It's just that consistently every great power invents some kind of ideology to justify.
It's a strategy that's recurring
throughout
history.
We're doing it to liberate you. White man's burden. It's to, in the case of the Germans, it's to free the French from socialism. And Blum, there was their socialist prime minister.
Well, and
that's, there's always got to be some rationale.
Well, and that's the other thing, you know, for backing. Again, like I say, there's nothing new in history. Nobody ever does anything for the first time. You know, the Nazis said that the Breton militia were the freedom fighters in France, you know, out there fighting against the communists. And the Breton militia perpetrated some of the worst excesses of the Holocaust.
With the Germans.
They were Nazi collaborators with the Holocaust. What they were was Breton ultra-nationalists, Breton fascists. And they perpetrated some of the worst crimes of the Holocaust.
Excuse me, Marchand, if we move back to our current war, Obama has announced that he's withdrawing our troops from Iraq. Is this because of the goodwill of Obama, or is this because we're being forced to?
It's really because we're being forced to. I mean, on the one hand, Obama said, I want to keep 10,000 troops in Iraq. And Muqtada al-Sadr. 20,000 troops in Iraq. And Muqtada al-Sadr, he is a prominent Shia cleric, he's a member of the government, and most notably the head of the Mahdi army. And these are probably the strongest militia in Iraq. And to give you a little history on them, they were the ones who bloodied our nose in the Battle of Najaf. And for anyone who's interested, there was a History Channel documentary on a series called Shootout about the Battle of Najaf. They stopped the Marines in their tracks. They stopped the 7th Cavalry in its tracks. I mean, these guys were no joke. And these guys fought against Saddam. And they're very well armed and trained by Iran, by the Quds Force.
It's just a backstory. The Shia sympathizers with the Iranians.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a Shia militia. Yeah.
So that we invaded Iraq in 2003, it was dominated by the Sunni minority under Saddam Hussein, and we essentially used the Shiite resentment against the Sunni minority in order to help topple his government, and now the new regime is a Shiite regime.
Right. Exactly.
We liberated them.
Okay.
Exactly. And this, and this, you know, Shia militia, which is an army by any stretch of the imagination. We think militia, we think some guys in Montana talking to God on a two-way radio. But these guys really are, you know, they're a legitimate army. And Muqtada al-Sadr said, if you leave behind any U.S. troops, we will kill them. Plain and simple. And the Iraqi government said, we will not give them immunity from punishment for war crimes. So what happens? Obama then says, okay, we'll leave behind only 10,000. And Muqtada al-Sadr says, not good enough. Anybody who leaves behind after December 31st is dead. And then Obama said, we're withdrawing everyone. Because the American people right now don't have the will to enter another brutal insurgency in Iraq.
But instead of looking like a coward, he comes back to the American people and looks like a hero by saying, I'm ending the war. We're bringing everybody home now. You can thank me for coming through on my campaign promise.
Of course. There's the campaign. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're talking about the global wars. And I think we're going to be talking about some of the candidates feel about it. Call in at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Or email us and we'll read your question or your comment on the air to ken@mdrtalk.org.
And I think tangentially related to what we were talking about is the rise in Iranian influence in Iraq, but also the fact, though, that we're not entirely withdrawing because of the rise in Iranian influence, we're not entirely withdrawing from Iraq. I think that was something you had mentioned to me earlier.
Yeah, I was actually looking yesterday at the article printed on the 29th in the New York Times. They use some very Orwellian doublespeak to explain Orwellian, a word that we learned last week with our guest Mark Dice. for those of you who are listening, they use words like repositioning. We're not withdrawing, we're repositioning our soldiers, and we're sending them to places like Kuwait, and we're steaming in new warships to the Persian Gulf so that we can station them in a place very strategically located and close to Iraq.
And just where is Kuwait? It's like in the corner, the southeast corner of Iraq.
Yeah, right? and
arguably a province of Iraq, so it's a very good position to have our army.
Yeah, the New York Times says that we're seeking to expand military ties with the six nations in the Gulf Cooperation Council: Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman. And, you know, and I have an underline under Bahrain and a little side note on this printout. It says, but what about all the protests and human rights violations? What about the double standards? Talk about that.
That's the absurdity of U.S. foreign policy. But it's been the absurdity of U.S. foreign policy since time immemorial. You know, we back dictators like Hosni Mubarak. You know, this is the example of democracy. And here this man is tearing up people's fingernails, you know, for protesting. Literally. In fact, actually, I was reading a case in Bahrain where there is the systematic rape of Shia women by members of Bahraini security forces. And presumably these people are our allies. But it's, you know, we really have no standard when it comes to human rights abuses. We merely use that when we want to topple somebody, when there's somebody we don't like,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
Oh, Gaddafi, he's doing this and that, and, you know, we got to get rid of this bad man. Meanwhile, Bahraini security forces are raping women, and we don't say a word about it. It's the doublespeak.
The Saudis sent their army into Bahrain right after meeting, I believe, with our Secretary of Defense. So it's pretty clear that we were on board with it.
Oh, yeah, and it's because we're terrified that Bahrain might become independent, that they might topple that despot, King Hamad, and his uncle Khalifa, the prime minister, were terrified that they might topple those despots and put in a government which might be pro-Iranian.
And what kind of faith do they practice in that area?
The population of Bahrain is predominantly Shia, as well as the population of East Saudi Arabia is predominantly Shia.
Man, it's so funny how that keeps popping up.
There's a pattern here. We back Wahhabi fundamentalists like the NTC.
And what are the Wahhabists?
Oh, the Wahhabists, yeah. Sorry, I keep getting ahead of myself a little bit. The Wahhabists are...
Remind us.
That's the doctrine that's adhered to by the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Uh-huh.
It's a very fundamentalist doctrine. It was founded by...
i.e. the bad guys.
The bad guys.
In air quotes.
Exactly. All doing air quotes. And, you know, it was founded by a man named Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab in the 18th century. And it's a very primitive understanding of Sharia law. It's something that most Muslims, at least I would say 98% of Muslims, do not agree with. It's a very radical. And they also – it's the doctrine that endorses suicide bombing, that endorses the murder of civilians, that endorses this very rigid, again, Taliban-style Sharia law.
Okay.
But it's something that holds no popular belief. It's also rabidly anti-Shia. They consider the Shia – unbelievers, Kafirs.
So they're Sunnis. The Wahhabis are Sunnis.
The Wahhabis are Sunnis. They're Sunni fundamentalists. Again, most majority scholars disagree with what the Wahhabis say. They say the Shia aren't unbelievers. You can't go and exterminate Shia. You can't go and blow yourself up. But the people we back are always these Wahhabi fundamentalists. It builds strife in the Muslim world because it polarizes.
Okay, so the minorities, or is it the oppressed majorities in Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, those are Shia or Sunni?
In most of Saudi Arabia, it's Sunni majorities that are oppressed, and they use the Wahhabis to kind of pay them off, say, oh, see, you're really angry. You know, Israel's to blame. The U.S. is to blame, but don't overthrow, you know, King Abdullah.
So take your anger to Afghanistan with the Mujahideen or whatever. Go someplace else.
Yeah, just don't overthrow King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. In the case of Bahrain and in the case of eastern Saudi Arabia, it's a Shia majority. And the Wahhabi strength is used to crush any Shia resistance. And it's something we sponsor because we feel it'll push back the influence of Iran, which is majority Shia, which in Iran's constitution says its duty is to liberate the oppressed Muslims of the world.
Okay.
So while we play this public game where we're opposed to extremists, fundamentalists, terrorists, in sort of realpolitik, we make alliances with any faction, no matter how extreme, that we feel will advance our short-term interests in the region.
Well, and we will literally make alliance with terrorist organizations, and there are two really good examples. One is the Mujahideen al-Haq in Iran, and another group called Jundallah, and these are two Sunni fundamentalist organizations which are dedicated to the toppling of the Iranian government through acts of terrorism. They're known to blow up innocent women and children, blow up mosques. And in fact, actually,
They're Wahhabists.
They're Wahhabists, okay. Exactly. And I have a very actually interesting article.
What are their names again?
The Jundallah, which means soldiers of God, and Mujahideen al-Haq, which I think means Mujahideen of Truth, something to that effect. Mujahideen meaning like volunteer soldiers, soldiers of God, very loosely translated. What's really interesting, I actually just pulled up an article on from Press TV, and it says that the Iraqi foreign minister, Zebari, says Baghdad is determined to close down Camp Ashraf. Now, Camp Ashraf is a camp in Iraq that was established by the U.S. for protecting Iranian dissidents, members of this terrorist organization, Mujahideen al-Haq. So we this is the equivalent of doing everything that we accused all Saddam of doing, harboring al-Qaeda terrorists, doing what we accuse al-Assad in Syria of doing, harboring terrorists. Everybody we don't like harbors terrorists. Yet what we're doing is harboring terrorists. And it's open. This is not, you know, you can look this up. Look up Mujahideen al-Haq. Look up Jundallah. And you can see the connections. These aren't, this isn't conspiracy. These aren't conjecture. These, the facts are right there.
And we're harboring them on a place that's on the border of the place that they're targeting. So that's why Iraq is so important here. They're on the border, for God's sake.
Exactly.
I mean, it's so easy for them to just go across the mountain and just go back in and do some terror. I mean, to destabilize the country.
Oh, absolutely. And especially,
and of course, Iraq itself has 120 billion barrels of proven crude and oil, and very high quality.
That tends to play a role as well. I mean, but who needs oil?
I want to jump back to the Saudi situation, because I pulled up an article from Haaretz yesterday, and I don't know if you saw this, but it's, the headline is Saudi Royal offers $900,000 reward for capture of Israeli soldiers. Did you see that?
No, I didn't actually. This
seems big to me, because it says Khaled's offer comes days after the prominent Saudi cleric Awad al-Karni put $100,000 on the head of every Israeli soldier. And just to read the first paragraph, it says, a Saudi royal offered $900,000 reward to anyone who captures an Israeli soldier on Saturday. Prince Khaled bin Talal, the brother of business tycoon and Fox News co-owner Walid bin Talal, that's key, told the Saudi-based broadcaster Al Dalil that the captive would then be released in exchange for Arabs held in Israeli prisons. Khaled's offer comes days after the prominent Saudi cleric, $100,000 on the head of every soldier. Carney's statement posted on Facebook was severely criticized. My offer also comes in response to the threats made against Sheikh al-Karni. So this looks like they're trying to put a price on getting captives and then exchanging them for captives. What do you make of that?
Well, I think part of that is, I mean, the Egyptians just traded an Israeli spy for a whole bunch of Egyptians who were captured by the Israelis. I think a lot of this has to do with – a lot of it's placating the masses, you know, because we don't consider –
You don't think it's real? It's bluster?
I think it's real, but I think the Israelis aren't particularly concerned by it. And I think if anything, they can use it to hype up their own masses.
Well, they know it's a dangerous world anyway, so
exactly.
It's not like they have to be any safer than they already are, you know?
Exactly. It's basically good propaganda, because there isn't a fear that Saudi Arabia will invade Israel. They are terrified of Iran, because they know Iran might pummel Tel Aviv, or that Iran's satellite Lebanon might pummel Tel Aviv.
And so Saudi Arabia is kind of split in its support for Iran?
Well, it doesn't support Iran. Rather, what Saudi Arabia is trying to do is placate is two portions of the population, experienced some recent protests. Most of the population, particularly almost across the board in the Muslim world, is opposed to the occupation of Palestine.
Yeah.
And they're opposed to what the Israelis are doing, I mean, the blockade, the genocide, all the rest of it. But the governments of these countries know that if they openly support Israel, they will be toppled. So what they do is they play both sides. They say, oh, we're going to, you know, we want $100,000 for the head of every Israeli. And then at the same time, though, they're going to harbor half a million U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia.
Probably most firmly under the umbrella of the United States.
See, I'm so confused by Saudi Arabia, though. I'm so confused by it.
They exist because of us.
I mean, we know that they in this whole thing with the supposed terrorist from Iran here with the car salesman trying to kill the Saudi Arabian royal. But I'm so confused because there's Shia in Saudi Arabia who obviously must sympathize with Iran. But at the same time, financially, the Saudi royals have backed Iraq and killed Iranians during the Iraq-Iran conflict, and you know, like,
well, the royals are all Sunni; they're all Wahhabis.
Yeah, okay.
So the Shia in the east, of Saudi Arabia, sorry, get my geography right, in the east of Saudi Arabia are predominantly they're a minority. They're really an oppressed minority. So their voice...
They're non-issue. Except for in revolt? Could they have a popular revolt?
That's why the Saudis were so interested in squashing the revolt in Bahrain.
And why the United States hasn't lifted a finger to assist.
Exactly. Also, a lot of the oil wells, prominent Saudi oil wells, are on top of land where the Shia live.
Oh.
So, but the
pesky poor people.
Exactly. You know,
they're always where we don't want them to be.
There are too many poor people in this world. You know, it's the case of the haves and the have-nots. The only difference is, you know, the haves are always saying the have-nots are trying to take everything from us. And, you know,
the have-nots are just trying to get by.
Yeah, the have-nots are just trying to get by, and the haves are trying to get rid of the have-nots. But be that as it may, it's complicated. But the fact is that the Saudi leadership is trying to placate the Sunni masses that are really angry about the occupation. They're trying to direct their anger, saying, oh no, don't revolt against us. See, we don't like Israel. We don't like what the Israelis are doing. It's, you know, redirecting anger. It's kind of like similarly to the way we say, you know, the American people are ticked off because they're losing their jobs. You know, student loans are through the roof. So instead of getting them angry at the Federal Reserve, we say, get angry at the 1%. Ooh, go after the 1%. Instead of go after the Federal Reserve. So it's a kind of misdirection.
The elusive 1%.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context on WPKN FM 89.5 in Bridgeport. The name of the show is In Context, and we're doing our monthly war report. If you'd like to weigh in on the question of the day, which is, are these wars that are around the world that the U.S. are involved in, are these wars in the interests of the United States or the interests of the American people? And the number is 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756, or email us at ken@mdrtalk.org. What do you think about these wars? And what do you think about the candidates who are running for president? Do any of them have anything to add to this?
And I believe we have a caller.
All right.
Hello, caller. You're on the air within context. What's your question?
Not a question, just to weigh in about how long we have been kind of backing the wrong guy.
Sure. Where are you calling from, caller?
Connecticut.
Oh, okay. Just in general?
Yeah. In the Serbian versus, you know, Croatian war, we definitely took the wrong side there. I mean, everyone was doing their own ethnic cleansing, but...
Caller, just turn your radio down, please.
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, I heard the echo.
No problem. Continue.
But thank you. Our support for Bahrainian government, it's not non-existent. I think Obama just made a deal for like 50 Hummers for the Bahrainian government that are equipped with missile launching tubes, and those are also infrared night vision missiles that you can target people infrared from the sky.
So who would these missiles be used against, most likely?
Well,
they're sold to the Bahrain government, but they're going to use it to quell uprisings. And they just—I think they were shooting protesters just last week or 2 weeks ago.
Actually, a report on Press TV, I keep the news up whenever I'm here, said that I believe it was, counting for time difference, yesterday, actually, Saudi-backed Bahraini forces attack anti-government protesters in Nuweidrat near Manama, the capital of Bahrain. So it's what's interesting, though, is if you look at photographs of all these Bahraini forces, they're all carrying U.S.-made or U.S.-supplied weaponry. They're wearing U.S.-made Kevlars, wearing U.S.-issue
IEDs. Yeah, you know what? And this is not lightweight weaponry either. This is maiming, killing, you know, just taking down buildings and houses weapons.
Oh, and talk about...
They're not using sandbag shotguns like riot police. They're firing bullets.
In fact, when the U.S. media first reported the shootings of the protesters in what was Pearl Roundabout until they blew it up, the government did, the U.S. media reported that these protesters had been killed by less than lethal rounds. Well, I looked at the photographs of the bodies, and I can tell you for a fact, as somebody who's experienced with firearms, I grew up around firearms, these guys were shot with buckshot, with lead pellets, because the guys had holes all over them. Rubber bullets don't leave holes throughout your body. These guys were shot point blank in a close spread with shotguns.
Caller, can I get your thoughts on two questions? If you could change our policy in that region, what would you have us do? And do you see any candidates who are close to what you would like to see done?
As far as candidates, I'm not really, like, I kind of, you know, laissez-faire. I try to stay out of it, but sometimes I can't help but get angry at what I see going on. And one thing I'd like to see is almost a cutting off of any supply. Like, if we're America, stop giving weapons, you know, to anyone who's going to just do harm to someone else. Send food, send medicine, send Red Cross, send UN workers, but stop selling weapons to the people you're going to be invading, the, you know, a month later.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I really appreciate the call. And
thank you very much, caller.
Thank you very much for your call.
I think he really reflects a lot of people's opinions out there, because, you know, he says, you know, he did use the word laissez-faire with politics, but unfortunately, having that attitude is what got us into this mess. And I'm not blaming the caller, because he has every right to feel betrayed by the government.
Because you do get angry when you listen to these candidates, and they all say the same thing. And we should be having a great debate in this country over the war. And I listen to the Republican debates, and by and large, they don't talk about the war. And that's it's not only killing a lot of people, it's killing our economy. Our war budget's almost $1 trillion, and we have huge unemployment.
Piggybacking off of that, not only they're not talking about it, but we see – well, I mean, everyone but Ron Paul. But what I see in the mainstream media is an outright blacklisting of information, you know, and that even goes down to the supposed free internet. You know, over the weekend, I saw a big story about the Google-owned YouTube website, the popular media sharing website where you can upload personally produced independent videos. And it could be searched and viewed by the entire world. And you think that that's open source information, except that they've been censoring videos uploaded from Libyan hospitals of children with their mouths and their chests blown open and legs hanging off. And these are little kids who are completely innocent, who our Peace Prize winning president said we were going over to protect.
That's right. The UN resolution that authorized the force in Libya mainly by NATO was intended to protect civilians.
And we're dropping American bombs in civilian centers, destroying their water supply, their sewer supply, their electrical supply, their ports, their roads, taking down buildings full of innocent people. And Google is going to go and block the videos, because YouTube, the methods they've been using is they've been blocking the searchability of the videos by making people register to watch them and then having to put your age in and saying that it's obscene material.
Meanwhile, you can see pictures of Gaddafi's corpse anywhere on CNN.
Exactly, wheeled around on a donkey cart for everyone to see, because that's the bad guy and that's our prize. We can wheel him around.
Well,
but
we
the
talked
dead children,
about earlier about how we make these alliances of convenience with radicals, and Libya was a good example, because what was the organization, the Al-Qaeda?
Oh, the Islamic Fighting Group, which is a Al-Qaeda affiliated organization.
They were our key allies in overthrowing Gaddafi, right?
This is how absurd our media is getting. I mean, when you look at this, we back openly now Al-Qaeda affiliated organizations, never mentioned. You know, the kids are getting blown up by American bombs, never mentioned. And, you know, let me just ask something to the listeners. If you were the parent of a Libyan child who's just had his or her legs blown off and they're screaming for their mom or their dad, how would you feel? You know, and meanwhile, the U.S. has put in a group of thugs and goons who are, you know, can perpetrate mass executions and murder of civilians. How would you feel?
Well, we would like to hear your views on any aspect of this global war, and whether you think it's benefiting our country, what you think our policy ought to be, by calling us at 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756, and Gus and Marchand and I, and my name is Ken, will be happy to talk to you, or you can email us if you rather at ken@mdrtalk.org.
We actually have another call. March, why don't you just bang it in?
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Where are you calling from?
Yes, I'm from South Carolina. I'm in Connecticut to see my grandchild.
Okay.
And,
go ahead, Cole.
I think the impression you're giving is that we really shouldn't have supported the NATO effort in Libya, and that getting rid of Gaddafi was really not worth it, that as long as there is collateral damage, we should not be involved in any kind of...
What are your feelings on it, caller? What are your feelings on that issue?
Well, I think that we exercised restraint by not sending troops into Libya, and... that we have ultimately been successful in getting rid of a oppressive regime.
What was the mission, though? Was it humanitarian protection, or was it regime change?
The the mission was a combination of the two, and it's awfully hard to sort out what the motives of every participant was. But I think that if you look at overall the problems that that regime caused for the population at large.
Well, the population at large had free education, health care, and booming industrial services. Well, so, I mean, are they better off now?
One thing that Marchand has helped me understand and provided with more information about situations like Libya is the many different motives apart from the ones which are presented to us, which are probably more important. For example, the fact that China, with whom we're in a great struggle for control of oil, had established a huge base in Libya. It was driving a lot of oil from Libya. They had about 30,000 workers who were expelled. So in this overall global strategic game, which they talk about in the Pentagon but not on CNN, Libya was a key player for us. Also, it was one of the very few countries I learned that did not have a military alliance with the United States, one of only five countries. And, of course, they did have a $100 billion sovereign wealth fund in Libya that Gaddafi was using to try to make Africa independent from the Western banking system. So all of these important issues don't really get played out through the press, our corporate media, but they're there.
Well, and I think an important issue, I mean, you know, caller, I certainly agree Gaddafi was – he wasn't a nice guy.
No, he was a jerk.
He was a jerk. He was a despot. But you compare it with the fact that we back despots all over the world. What made this
ever? Oh, you know, yes. Look, you know, everybody knows. Go back to the problem in Iran. I mean, we overthrew a democratic government in Iran, and look what we got.
Yes, exactly. Correct.
We are not guilt-free, that's for sure.
Right.
My only question to you is, do you think that we should have just left Libya alone?
Yes.
And okay, well, that's your point. Thank you very much for your program.
Oh, well, thank you, caller.
Thank you. I mean,
thanks very much, caller.
Certainly, I think that
I think if I just listened to the mainstream media, I would come to the conclusion that the caller came to, I think.
Well, I think the caller did have an interesting point that, I mean, Gaddafi was a despot, and if we were pure intention and we replaced it with a democratic government that benefited the people, certainly that would not be a bad thing.
But I think the biggest issue is, can we do that? I think the only way you have a democratic government is if the people do it themselves. Like in Iran, in 52, they had their own democracy that they instituted, right? We had nothing to do with that. But then we overthrew it promptly.
Yeah.
We cannot institute democracy anywhere.
The bottom line is always economic self-interest, and the rest is window dressing. And if you look at Iran, of course, we overthrew Mossadegh. The next year, we overthrew the democratically elected leader of, Guatemala, Arbenz,
in
1954. Why? Because he threatened the financial interest of the United Fruit Company, whose former lawyer was their Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles. Why did we overthrow the democratically elected head of Chile in the 1970s? Because the copper companies didn't like the fact that he was going to nationalize them. So we always have to readjust the propaganda. But at the bottom, it's always about money. It's always about economic
and commercial interest.
And it's really hard to fight that and see through that when every day you're bombarded with, to go back to William Randolph Hearst when he was going to promote the war against Spain in 1898, he said to Frederick Remington, "Mr. Remington, you give me the pictures and I'll give you the war."
Well, and I think, in the case of Gaddafi, I think, just to really hit on the caller's question, I think Gaddafi was a despot. He did some horrible things, but does it give us the right to invade, to bomb another country, to do horrific damage to its population, and then install what is admittedly now a non-democratic fundamentalist regime? You know,
it's disingenuous. We know, it's
but especially one that isn't any more fair than the one before. You have to keep that in mind.
The
powers who are in control now are going to be far more oppressive than Gaddafi ever was. That's the biggest issue here. My concern is for the children of Libya. Why should they have their legs blown off by the tens of thousands because we have personal vendettas against people? These guys have been going around with machetes killing black Africans because they aren't part of the Wahhabist movement. You know, that's much, much worse than anything Gaddafi ever did.
Exactly.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the AIM program is In Context, and we very much appreciate your calls, whatever your point of view is. We very much want you to call in and express that point of view. The public airways, they belong to you. And our number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756, or email us at ken@mdrtalk.org. Name of the program is In Context, and we're doing our monthly review of the global war. The question that we're asking, and we're not asking this disingenuously, is this war in the interests of the United States, the American people? What do you think about that that question? You had mentioned, we're talking briefly about Africa, and that's one of the big news of recent weeks, is the decision by Obama to deploy troops to Uganda, right? In fact, to other countries, not just Uganda. He said the troops could go to southern Sudan, to the Central African Republic, and to the Congo. What is the reason why we're sending troops to Africa?
Ostensibly, it is to combat the Lord's Resistance Army, yet another evil terrorist organization that we must squash in the name of democracy.
They're
and
popping
freedom.
Up like gremlins.
Exactly, you know. Well, and the fact is, these guys have been around, and they for 20 years, and for the last 20 years, they've been committing some of the worst atrocities known to man. I mean, the Lord's Resistance Army hacks off fingers, lips, ears, nose.
Yeah.
You know, it's just these horrible human rights abuses, yet we ignored them and said nothing about them. In spite of the fact that the head of the Lord's Resistance Army was indicted for war crimes many years ago, we have done nothing up until just now, which, interestingly enough, the Lord's Resistance Army operates in Uganda, Central African Republic to the north, the Congo to the east, and in the northeast, they operate in southern Sudan. They also have been sponsored by the government, the Sudanese government in Khartoum. It's just a little unusual because the Khartoum government is Muslim, the Lord's Resistance Army is fundamentalist Christian, but they're a convenient tool because they extend the Sudanese influence in Africa. They extend
the
influence.
It seems like this is a foothold because it's coming 20 years after this. In fact, I think the atrocities were in decline, or this man's power, the Lord's Resistance Movement. In any event, the question that's been pointed out by even the corporate media is, why didn't we do this before if this is the real reason? And it seems perhaps that there are two other reasons. One is, of course, is the absolute importance of the minerals in the Congo and the other in that region, the oil in southern Sudan. And the other is that we want maybe want to do a favor for this government because it boils down to
in the end is China, because the Lord's Resistance Army is backed by Khartoum. Khartoum is backed by China. So it really, it's an extension of Chinese influence. And if they control the minerals, I'm sure Chinese companies are going to get preference.
That's right. Well, that's the whole Darfur tragedy was largely about the conflict with China over oil.
So I think a lot of this is I definitely think what you mentioned plays a role. You know, I think we're definitely doing a favor to the Ugandan government. But I really think what in the end it boils down to is, as you said, the minerals and who's going to control the minerals. And if we get rid of the Lord's Resistance Army, we've effectively eliminated any Sudanese or, by extension, Chinese influence in the region.
But it also means whenever we do a favor, I don't use your word, we don't do any favors for anybody. A favor from our military is like a favor from the mafia. You know, they expect payback.
Well, you know, that means
bases. You know, any base
course,
that we set up an airstrip, they're going to say, well, yeah, sure, we'll put a drone airstrip in there, but it's going to stay forever.
Is it AFRICOM, which was founded about 5 years ago, never mentioned on CNN, but this is really important.
Yep.
We never had a military command for Africa, but 5 years ago we got it, and it came on the heels of an important report outlining the strategic importance of Africa's oil. And this government report estimated we'll be getting 25% of our oil from Africa. So this is a really key thing. So now we have divided Africa, believe it or not, listeners, into five military districts. This is the United States. Five military districts.
Clearly our responsibility.
Right, under AFRICOM, and we are going to train a rapid deployment force of local troops, train and equip them for use, essentially as surrogates for the United States and NATO.
Think of the absurdity of this, though. This is like, you know, me saying anytime you want to move furniture in your house, you have to call me first so that I can clear it. You know, like this is this zone, the living room here, and then this is the kitchen here. Nothing can change until you call me and I come over and oversee it. You know, the absurdity is just off the charts here. here. If George Bush, the war criminal that he is, had done all this in Africa, obviously, you know, the word racist would have been thrown around.
It goes back to the
1890s. But our first African-American really? President, it's totally cool.
Well, that's he's a good cover that way. But, what our show in context is about understanding the history and the true motivations for what political figures are doing. And they're usually not the same as the ones that their press secretaries present at Washington press conferences. Uh-huh. This is really much more like 1884 when we had the Europeans had the Berlin Conference, and they literally divided Africa up into pieces.
Oh, yeah. Right? Turf.
What this really is, I mean, it's a, you know, nothing changes in history. Nothing is ever new in history.
And the question we're asking is what's good for the U.S.?
Exactly.
Right? What is good for the U.S.?
Well,
I mean,
that's what we're asking, but I think we also are trying to enlighten people as to the trends of history, because nothing changes in history. And if you can see the trends of history, you can see where your country is going, and you can stop history before it repeats itself, before Rome is sacked again, you know, as the saying goes.
Now, one of the trends that we've talked about in this show is the confrontation with China, Russia, and Iran, which we are heading towards, and we were alerting people to, that this could be a great tragedy for the United States. Later in this decade, step by step, we are confronting these great powers by attempting to cut off all of their sources of oil.
Yeah, the barbarian invasion of Rome by starving the outlying tribes is exactly what Rome did. They starved all their neighbors to the point where they decided, well, you know, we got nothing else to go for. The Huns, the Vandals, the Visigoths, they were all trading partners with Rome, and Rome cut off the tap, and they decided, well, you know, I guess we don't have a choice but to invade Rome.
I think people probably go along with a lot of this stuff because they just don't know how else things can operate economically. You really have to take a step back to think about it. From a humanitarian perspective, economically, there are a lot of solutions to these problems. You know, by allowing countries to maintain control of their own resources,
yes,
and kick out the corporations, because people out there, you see American companies like Mobil are out there getting the oil, or we're strip mining African countries. That profit by those corporations is not trickle down economics. That's hoarded by the top.
That's a really good point. What we think of as our government policy is really the policy of multinational
people think that we're benefiting from this. Well, this is why we're the most powerful, richest nation in the world. No, it's not. That has nothing to do with it. The only reason we maintained any level of education and standards is because the people demanded it and we produced it ourselves. All of the domestic consumption here is produced ourselves from our own hard work, and everything else is hoarded by I don't want to pin it on just the Wall Street guys, because that's such a blanket term. It's even higher than the Wall Street. It's the top floor of Wall Street. You know, it's like the 1% of the 1%.
And again, it's history repeating itself. Who did the Roman conquest profit? Were the big landowners. The conquest of the British Empire, they profited the industrialists.
Yeah.
We only have a few minutes left in our show, so if you want to get your call in, please give us a ring at 203-336-9756. We're talking about the global wars. 203-336-9756. What do you think about U.S. foreign policy? What do you think about it? Do any of the candidates running for president have anything to say which you think is going to improve our position in the world?
Well, I hear from guys like Rick Santorum and Michelle Bachmann and their buddy Peter King, who's a New York representative. He's not running for president, but they all say the same thing. They scare the hell out of me, because it's we're going to protect Israel at the threat of thermonuclear war or Martian invasion no matter what, and we're just going to kill anybody necessary to protect Israel and make sure that America stays number one.
You know, the Republican Party was not the party of military intervention until modern times, and the party must have amnesia, and this show is not a partisan show. We're neither left nor right.
We have a call?
Oh, sure.
Hello, caller. Please go ahead. What's your question or comment?
So, this will never change. We will always repeat history, because history is always about the same thing.
Uh-huh.
It used to be more about the spoils like gold and maybe gemstones, and there's some value there for certain reasons. But really what you're seeing play out is it's us versus China. And we're trying to sort of divide that map, figuring that everybody wants the oil because it's needed. And the corporations that run the government know that that's the best place to get free military services to protect their interests. has nothing to do with caring for the people.
Right.
You know, and
do you think, Carla, do you think we'd be better off if we negotiated with China? And this is kind of not, it's in a kind of an amoral way, and say, look, we know you need a lot of oil. We're not going to try to dominate the whole world and control all the oil. Let's just come to an entente where you get what you need, we get what we need, and we don't go into a major war with each other. Is that a possible scenario?
Well, here's the thing. In order to keep the masses happy, you have to keep driving down the cost of goods since they don't have any money to buy them. And the Chinese are making those goods. It's a lot harder to deal with the Indians because the Indians, many of them, because they didn't get enough to eat, their brains don't fully form, and literally they're mental midgets. You know, have brilliant Indians, but you have a lot of them that can't really work. The work ethic in China might be higher, or just the skill set may be better.
Well, I know a lot of.
He
don't know about metal midgets. I know a lot of really smart Indians.
No. He makes a good point, though. He makes a good point because this is an old tactic where the feudal lords of Europe would make sure that their serfs were not even able to hunt rabbits. And if they found a rabbit trap out in the woods, they would be put to death or have their hands cut off because they wanted to make sure that the only people getting nourished well enough were the lords and their warriors.
I see.
And it made sure that they were developed. They were short, they were weak, and they were not able to think for themselves.
The king's land, in essence. Hunting in the king's forest.
So it's an old tactic, and the guy makes a good point. They don't do it to the point where they stop you from hunting. But they keep you so oppressed that you're not able to purchase healthy food. I mean, here in America, the only food most people can afford on their food stamps is high fructose corn syrup and GMO corn, right?
It is very pernicious. It is the diet that we have. It makes us sick, and then large corporations are making a fortune for insurance companies and manufacturers of these expensive diagnostic
it's like
machines
and
drug companies.
Yeah.
They make you sick, and then they charge up the wazoo to
it's a self-destructive scavenger mentality. It's almost like, you know, we're run by a class of viruses who have assimilated our bodies, and they're just able to, you know, feed off of our hard work. We have one more call. I think we have just enough time to take it.
Oh, great. Hello, caller.
Caller, where are you calling from?
Where are you calling from?
Where am I calling from? I'm calling from the same place I was calling for before.
Oh, okay. Well,
we
have to wrap it up. So you want to finish your point?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
You're in a race to the bottom, and your planet is literally failing right now. Most people don't recognize that. You also see that the leaders in this country, many of them don't realize that Occupy Wall Street movement isn't going to go away, and the sooner they recognize that there's a need to change, the better. Unfortunately, I think the planet will shrug us off because our interests will be, and energy and money will be spent fighting wars and over the spoils while your planet melts and you fail completely to truly act with a worldwide concerted force because you're on a boat, you're headed to the edge of the waterfall. Are you going to try to turn it around, or are you just going to have another beer? And unfortunately, I think most people are going to reach for the beer.
So in a sense, the problem is spiritual, you might say.
We're the only species that works really hard to make itself extinct.
Yeah.
And it's truly frightening because this is not going to be fun. The weather yesterday wasn't fun, and it's only going to get worse.
Well, Carl, we thank you so much for your call.
Thanks, we have to wrap it up now.
We're out of time.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay.
So just 30 seconds to go. Any last thoughts or remarks?
If anyone wants to go see Henry Kissinger, chief globalist and virus of humanity, he's going to be at the Hyatt Regency on Friday, November 4th from noon to 2. And if you have $400, you can go and see him speak and heckle him, hopefully.
I'll get a whole table.
Oh, joy.
Yeah, thank you for listening. You've been listening to In Context with Gus Canavero, Ken McDermott Rowe, and our military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. We'll see you next time. We're on Mondays between noon and 1 p.m. And our website is incontextreport.com.
See you, everybody. Find us on Facebook.